This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 29th of December, 1951. The title of this lecture is Cause on All Dynamics. This lecture is 60 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
I have a horrible subject to talk to you about tonight as the first part of this lecture. The second part will be devoted to the use of the handbook. But the first part will be devoted to something that, there's some parts of it that are just not quite as nice as they might be. And would anybody under 14... It's taken me a long time to get the ammo stuffed into the breech and the pointer on his ledge and the gun pointed in the right direction and the trainer swiveled around in the right direction and get a hand on a lanyard. Well, I happen to believe in action. Yes, sir. Lots of action. As a philosopher, I am a complete bust. Because a philosopher, you know, he's supposed to sit around and everything is all set for an individual, you know, as long as he can, if he's just permitted to think, maunder around and monkey around with something and, write it down in a book and let the book get dusty and write some more, let that one get dusty. No, I was interested in the field of engineering because engineering built things. And I found out that when you tried to build things in this world, the steel would stand up, but the human beings wouldn't. Isn't that interesting? And so, I decided to do something. I possibly could. Well, wasn't quite a bit done about it. But the direction of it is action. Definite action. Got a world here today, everybody busy blowing each other up and secret police running inside and outside and economics going up and down like barometers before the hurricane and people shivering their tracks and the workers all throwing down their chains so people can put bigger chains upon them. Institutions being built to take care of the insane so that you can have more insane. People being thrown on operating tables, hacked all up. Kids started into their lives with 8 strikes against them. Everybody busy fighting for a little piece of dirt that's floating around in the solar system. Boy, what a limited view man has had. Well, try to do something about that. It takes action. It's production of an attitude of mind capable of constructively resolving the problems of man and delivering into his hands the conquest of the material universe. It happened to lie through the field of epistemology, which lay through the human channel there, went through the human mind. And that all leads out into action. Well, this gun is pointed, laid, trained, loaded, cocked. Taken a year and a half to find out how people had to be told, how you told people to do what to produce a frame of mind which came up the tone scale to a point where we all went, hey, my dear, do you know, big goal in life. The big goal in life of, if I can undermine his character enough, I'll get his job. The big goal in life of, if we create enough scarcity, then prices will go up and I'll get rich. You know, this sort of thing. Well, looks to me you'll be refining the edges on this for some time, like we got that blast ready to blow. So, this is the last conference I'll talk at. I may go out to Keokuk or your town. But there is in existence now a package which handles this with ramifications, so that you in the field, wherever you are not occasioned too much turmoil or difficulty because of some alteration in the package. This bridge is built pretty wide now. And as a net result, we can be a cause which will undoubtedly produce at least a very interesting effect upon the society. I didn't quite get the straight of this the other day. I understood, somebody read to me over the phone, something about Winchell. Mentioned Hubbard, mankind is worth saving, don't quit. Something of that sort. I thought that was very sweet of him. Who the hell's been talking about quitting? It's one of Gene Benton's new formulas. Just a minute while I get myself up above 1.5. So when we think of cause and effect, the cause and effect situation in Dianetics is a very interesting one to examine. What are we trying to cause, and what will be the effect? Well, let me take that up a little later. Right now, let's just talk about the great purity of philosophy. Boy, I wish Kant were alive today. And Hegel and a few of the boys. Boy, would they have fun? Would they have fun? You keep showing them phenomena, and they would show you their mystic numbers. Of course, that kind of a situation can't exist today. Fortunately, we have an enlightened world. You can show individuals phenomena, and they immediately recognize them as phenomena and work with them. All right, cause and effect. Once upon a time, there was a life source. And it developed into a more complex life source. And it developed into a more complex life source. Well, we can say that what it was trying to cause, one of the things it was trying to cause, certainly, was a conquest of the material universe. That may be just one of its goals, but it's still a very important one. It's important because when you get an individual way up above 20, he starts to separate from the material universe. He's neither happy nor healthy nor anything else. Regardless of what he's trying to do, he starts going out through the top. He starts to leave the material universe, and he ceases to gain on his conquest of it. Now, when an individual goes down from 20, they as well lose contact and lose the ability to handle the material universe. You find a person operating at optimum, healthy, unworried, successful. Everything runs for him. Things work. He's riding there about 20 or 10 points either side. And good shape. Well, we can get into a big argument about whether or not an individual is in good shape when he's healthy and strong and happy and effective and efficient and so forth. Maybe that individual isn't in good shape. Maybe the ideal would be something else. I mean, maybe the ideal living organism would be something else. Possibly somebody could say, well, the ideal shape is to sit on a bed of spikes and be able to resist the pain of the spikes. Well, somebody else can say that if he wants to. But by God, he sure isn't going to get anything done. Now, that's a cinch. So what are we trying to cause? We'll just take it off at that and postulate that that's the cause, conquest, material, the universe. And when an individual begins to produce an effect, the effect he is producing, when it is a good effect, is an alignment of the inherent disorder in the physical universe. Now, when an individual fails as a cause, he becomes himself. His living body is part messed, you know. Even his own messed starts to demonstrate the chaotic effect of the material universe. A very ideal situation would be to be pure cause, but this is, of course, your ideal state of being, which is up above the level, not your ideal state of action, which I will go into a little bit later. Now, if an individual is fully responsible, then the individual is full cause, isn't he? Along all dynamics. If he is going to survive infinitely, something of that sort, he's again full cause. He says, I am, as his state of beingness. He goes into a big state of beingness, I am. That means I am cause. Now we notice, as we look this over, that two things happen to a human being. One, he ceases to desire to be a cause, or negates against being a cause, and he negates against being an effect. He does not want to be either a cause or an effect. He is a cause, and something happens, and it goes wrong, and therefore it is fault, blame, regret, so forth. All of these things follow out from cause, and he's in trouble. On the other hand, the individual does not want to be an effect of somebody else's cause. He fends off from being this. But on the other hand, an individual can desire to be a cause, and he can desire to be an effect. So actually, this thing works out the way you've seen so many of these things work out. There's up here, up along the top, you have desired cause. You have enforced cause. That's blame. You have inhibited cause. Now, over here, you have desired effect, enforced effect, and inhibited effect. Tone scale, 0, 4, this is about 2, and this is 20 up. Now, out of this formula, and you can call it a formula if you want to, because an awful lot of things work out when you start looking at this. Out of this come many complexities in the organization of living. Actually, it is a restatement of approval, regret, survive, full responsibilities, full state of beingness, and so forth. But it can be codified this way. Actually, you see, we're just making a restatement in terms of cause and effect. What's full responsibility? A fellow whose full responsibility is willing to have caused anything. Well, that's way up top. Desired cause. When you get an individual down the line to a point where he no longer desires to be cause, he is pretty bad off. When you take an individual and force the fact upon him that he is cause, Just the act of enforcing it upon him is blaming, you see. It says, your cause. And when he starts to blame himself finally, why, he comes down here to the point where he won't be cause for anything. He won't be cause for the satisfaction of his own hunger. He won't cause anything to happen. And over here, on the other side here, we have desired effect. Well, you'd be surprised how many effects there are that are desirable. There's the effect of food, clothing, shelter, and pleasure. Individuals desire to be in effect. Your old mystic, the old-time ascetic, oh, he knew exactly how you got yourself into this state of affairs where you went way up toward 40. He knew how you did it. You just said, no pleasure, no effect, no effect of anything. Of course, he went right on out through the top. He didn't accept any cause on the line particularly, but he refused to be an effect of any kind, and so there he went. You could see them today in India, up in the highlands. They are very interesting people, because they don't have much understanding of humanity. You go over there and you say it's all right to be sitting there with your legs crossed, with the lice running up and down in the hems of your white robe. It's not my idea of a good way to live life. Nothing happens. Now, on this desire to be in effect, your ascetic knows a lot better than to ever permit himself to be in effect of anything. Because the second he permits himself to be in effect, he opens the door to somebody else or something else's cause. There is contained in this the complete ramifications of how you go about being a saint. That's how you go about being a saint. And if you want to get there and become a saint, just to close all those doors of effect, and you'll be a saint. If you close the doors of food too, you'll be a dead saint, but it's all right. Now, here's effect. A person has to agree to be aberrated. That, by the way, is in the first handbook. Has to agree to be aberrated. Here's one of the methods he uses to agree. He wants to be affected this way and that way and some other way and some other way and some other way. And eventually he's got the doors wide open. And then anything can roll down that channel. He starts to hit a dwindling spiral the moment he wants to be in effect. Your young artist who says, ah, I want to live. I want to know how life will affect me. And so he finds out. He stops painting, too. Because as long as he's an artist, he's cause. As long as he's cause, he's an artist. And when he becomes effect, he becomes, well, chaotic, unplanning, so on. Now there's the second dynamic. Poor old Freud. He was so close aboard the boat that I suppose that was why society got so mad at him. But he was awful close aboard. When he developed the libido theory, he was looking right straight at this. There it was. You open the door to be an effect, but you become one. What you do to become an effect becomes then the channel of aberration. An individual says, I want to be affected pleasurably. I want to be very definitely and desperately affected. So forth. It's very interesting that he will be affected by his counter-efforts and by everything else. Now we take the second dynamic. There is a solid communication line on the second dynamic. tactile. You want to know why so many guys take their wives' orders? Very simple. They want to be in effect. They have a tactile communication line, and wifey says, go out and jump in front of the locomotive, please, and they do. Why? They're in effect. Therefore, they have elected her to be cause. And particularly if she's ornery about it, she's cause. Now, if she can ever accomplish getting blamed on the second dynamic, she's really cause. Now her word is law. That's how blame operates. Anything you blame becomes cause. So it goes higher and more powerful than you. And it can therefore and thereafter regulate you. You blame it, you say there's cause. You're saying at the same time, I'm not cause. I'm not cause. And thereafter, from that source, you get your orders. You want to know how to make an engram really effective against you? Is blame it on somebody. Blame its re-stimulation upon the auditor. Blame a dental operation upon the dentist. And that engram and dentists and auditors thereafter will have a peculiarly powerful effect upon you. If you want to get a pre-clear into a complete, apathetic, slavish state, in other words, if you want to get him into the state of a psychiatric patient, all you have to do is demonstrate to him that it's his fault, continually. Demonstrate to him that this was his fault and that was his fault, until all of a sudden he ceases to want to be cause. And then get him to blame you. And then get him to blame you. Blame you heavily. Blame you very heavily. And this is, by the way, psychiatric practice. And eventually, of course, you as auditor, if you can get him to blame you and blame you and blame you, you're pretty soon, you're really cause. You can say, do it, loop. You loop. That's how you set it up. You want to really rule an organization, be so ornery, so mean, and do so many overt acts that not an individual in that organization but will blame you. And after that, they do everything you say. Now, that's a heck of a note, isn't it? What's a marine company run so well for, huh? The officers in the Marine Corps know all about this, evidently. They evidently found out about this somewhere under the walls of Tripoli or something. They don't have anything much to do with the troops. They aren't the cause of anything or the effect of anything. Particularly, they sort of hold off and they go down along the line. They're the people who give the sergeants hell once in a while, maybe. They set a good example in battle. It's the British Army philosophy, British Marine Corps philosophy, that one's borrowed from. They get it all blamed on the sergeant. The sergeant, he takes all the blame. He gets all the blame. It's his fault, but it's also his blame. Everybody blames him actively, and you're all set. You've got a good, smooth-running company. Don't think of it for a moment that sergeant can come down along the line and go into ARC with all these enlisted men and have anything happen in that company. It won't. Why? Because he's not cause. They haven't elected him cause. Now, do you elect an individual cause by getting around and voting? No. Elected officers are rarely successful officers. Why? Well, you have to blame yourself. You elected them, didn't you? So, what you really should do is elect a group to appoint an officer. You get results then. Now, for instance, the government of the United States would be far more fascistic if Congress were permitted to select, after Congress was elected, a president. There you'd have it. You'd have a government there that would really be operating with a meat chopper. Only we don't want a government like that. Furthermore, we don't want all the government we pay for, thank God. Now, you open up a channel, you can expect that channel as you roll along to be an aberrated channel. This gives food, clothing, housing, and in particular sex, because it has a communication channel that's tactile, terrific emphasis. What do you worry about all the time? Food, clothing, shelter? The second dynamic. The only reason you worry about them, the only reason they don't happen automatically almost, is just you want to be in effect. So a person is made to work for his food. Now, it's a very funny thing that nobody ever got him to work for his aftershave lotion. Or nobody got him to work for other odds and ends, like a skiing trip to Sun Valley. And we'll give you the food. Doesn't quite work out. No, the employer has uniformly selected a channel where the individual is a necessity effect, and he uses that for pay. Also, he gets obedience when he does this. Now, as a matter of fact, there's a lot of lessons to be learned in here. There's a lot of things that have been overlooked. There's a lot of ways to crack a black snake whip over men. There's lots of ways to enslave them. There are lots of ways to undermine personalities and character and everything else in this thing. This is a real hot package. I think it would sell very, very quickly in Moscow or Washington. The package is hot. But it doesn't get very hot if an auditor knows about it. They scan everything. And every time in your life when you postulated to yourself that you wanted to be effected, an effect. Let's postulate every time you blamed anybody for doing something. Let's get those out of the line, and the first thing you know, the individual starts up the tone scale. Why does he start up the tone scale? Because you're taking away all the times when he desired to be an effect. Now, when an individual desires to be an effect of his own memories, this is really royal. Oh, man. A person starts in and he starts saying, well, I'd like to cherish this memory. That was an awfully good show. I'd like to think about that later. I hope nobody spoils this illusion for me. See, he's been an effect. He's been watching this beautiful picture, a dance or ballet or something of the sort. And he says, I want to cherish this memory. I want to keep this around and so forth. All of a sudden, he's assigned value to memory. Value to a facsimile. That's the first crime. Value the show, be damned. Go to it tomorrow night. Go to it next week or go to other shows. But the only moment you're alive is now. There isn't any other moment. But these individuals who pick up these past memories and cherish them, first thing you know, they find themselves cherishing material objects. And then they start wondering what the heck all this burden of psychosomatic is. And the next thing you know, why an auditor tries to get him to let go of this. Well, down at the bottom is a terrific desire to be in effect. You start going down the line, and you say, when did you want yourself to be influenced pleasantly by a memory? The guy sort of squirms for a minute. How'd you know? Freud was to some degree right. On the second dynamic, because of this tactile communication system, you have a setup, a complete setup. And then the society fixes up everybody by saying, no, 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 you're not 21 yet, and you have to get married. So the guy goes through all these teens desiring to be an effect. Every time he is, it's illegal in some fashion or other. So he not only desires to be an effect, but he has to hide the effect that pretty soon he hides it from himself. And somebody about the time he's 45, 50, something like that, is saying, I wouldn't go out with him. He loses his potency. Because he's hidden it all the way down the line. He's put it back here, see? He desired to be an effect, and then he says, mm-mm, I've got to hide this. Because if people found out the horrible things that I did, why, I would be ruined socially. So therefore, I have to hide all this wanting to be in effect. He's 32 years old. He goes to a motion picture. He sits there. He looks at all these... It shows the rock hits or something of the sort, and they're doing a beautiful dance, and he's sitting there, and he says to himself, the plot runs off in front of his face, and a couple of teenagers down the line, they seem to be getting a big bang out of this movie, but doesn't seem to be able to. And he goes outside, and he looks, and there's green grass, and there's blue sky, and a couple down the line seem to think that that's very nice, but for some reason or other, doesn't look very nice to him anymore. He all of a sudden realizes that the world is not pleasant to him, that he does not any longer experience pleasure. So then he cooks up a big dream of how he's really going through to make sure that Mary and the kids are secure or something, and nobly goes on his way. What he's actually done is desire to be in effect, hidden it, put it back, got up a lot of blame, and then out of fear of shame, which is what guilt is, it's down between 0.9 and 0.6, something like that, shame is, and he just hidden all this. He hides it from himself. His memories become dangerous. He does not dare exhibit his memory, so he starts telling people, well, I forget. I don't know her name. I don't know where that was. He knows he's dodging something, but he can't figure out quite what he's dodging. The facsimiles are really handling him. And right now, you should understand this point very clearly. There is a great world of difference between looking at present time reality and the memory of present time reality. That's why we're calling them facsimiles. Because you make a box top that looks just more or less like it and send it in and you get your spoon. It's a facsimile. It's not the real thing. And it's handling a memory. It is not handling a concrete past. Handling a memory. You're handling a motion picture reel or something of the sort. You're not handling a past. Now, you can go back down the time track and you can find the time you were in San Francisco or Dallas or someplace. And you can remember that right this minute. When you're in other place than here, you can remember that. Now, right here in present time, think how far away that was. Not in time, think in miles, distance, just get a concept of these towns being well over the horizon. They're a long way away. That's reality. But an individual who is building up a hide, building up a shame, getting all loused up with wanting to be in effect this way, that way, other ways, and so forth, eventually starts to hide his own memories. Take them all down, memories. And then all of a sudden he says, you know, I'm hiding these things, therefore they must be dangerous. You know, they must be awfully dangerous. I have to work so hard to hide them. And then he either gets to you or they get him. But there's a whole sphere of aberrative operation. A whole sphere is contained in this. A person's desire to be a cause. His efforts to keep from being an enforced cause, you're to blame. And his efforts to keep from having cause inhibited in him. What happens? What happens here? A couple doesn't want children. They don't want children. That's sex, desired cause of children. And the first thing you know, it isn't any fun anymore. They don't want to be cause, so they come down the tone scale. Second, they don't want to be cause, they start down the tone scale, and there goes the old shell game. Now, we take somebody that's lived around, this is 1-5. This is around grief. The person starts to cry. You talk to them crossly, roughly, something of the sort. You tell them they got to straighten up, and all of a sudden they begin to cry, quite unexpectedly. And you say, oh, gee, I was too rough. You didn't want to be a cause. You didn't want to be a cause of their tears. So you go into sympathy. But you also come away from this point. Mostly because you were operating from that point. See? Actually, most of the things that anybody's ever been mad about in this world don't amount to anything. You go back over the things that you've been mad about in the past, and if you really take a look at them, they look pretty silly to you. They're generally an effort to enforce cause elsewhere. That's really what anger is. And grief is, I'm not cause. Look what you've done to me. You've ruined me. That's grief. Apathy is, well, here I lie. You can't think I caused anything, can you? I'm innocent. Look at me. I'm innocent. But cause, real cause way up the top, as a matter of fact, gets confused by a 1-5 with 1-5 enforced cause. So a fellow who's causing something hits a 1-5, and the 1-5 says he's trying to force cause on me because he's forcing cause. He's trying to cause something, so therefore it's causing. So then, you know, therefore the only thing I can possibly do about the thing is stop it. So therefore I'll stop all cause that I see around, and I will pretend that I am cause. And I won't say I'm cause. I won't do anything to be cause, but I'll pretend I'm cause, and I'll tell everybody how much time I have to put in being cause all the time, but I won't do anything, so I won't have to be cause. And then I'll show them that they're cause, and then I'll get sympathy. And at 1-5, a guy really wants sympathy and approval. He's really trying to take a license out from you. If you ever doubt this, you get somebody who's terrifically angry at you sometime, and so on, and just question them about what approval you can show them. The guy will break down and he'll give you a complete explanation. Fabulous. A person at 1-5 is applying for a license. A license to survive. He's applying for it by making himself horrible to have around. At 0-5, he's making himself completely innocuous, innocent, enervated, foil thing. You wouldn't refuse me a license, would you? Way down here. So there's your gradient scale of cause. If you want to know where an individual on a tone scale is, you see how much he's willing to cause. But then look at the quality of what he's willing to cause. Now, on effect, the effect line, an individual can safely be an effect on any channel he wants to be an effect on. Completely safe to be an effect. As long as he doesn't negate being a cause on any channel. Because if he desires to be an effect, everything is all fine, but all of a sudden, he negates being a cause. He is primed to suddenly become an effect. Swish. And he'll get it. And there's the individual when you sit him down and you tell him to sit quietly and concentrate on nothingness. He then is an effect. You're making an effect out of him. And the more of an effect he is, the more counter efforts he will continue to get. Now, individuals who are sort of plowing through life, and they wanted to be an effect on many things, and they don't want to cause very much. They won't eat much, you know. They're kind of just maundering through life gradually, slow, carrying along. Well, they aren't a cause. They aren't an effect. But they sure are close to going out the bottom. And they sure give you, as an auditor, a lot of trouble. And one of the reasons they give you trouble is because they're not going to be an effect on what you say either, because that is the last ditch. So you find such people going around worrying about things like they have to concentrate on awfully hard on being right if they're going to be alive at all. They'll correct you and use an improper word. They'll leave an idea to go sidetracking over to make sure that this is all right, and so on. They'll do all sorts of interesting things. And they are an effect, but they're so close to being, how much of an effect can a person be? Well, dead. And they're so close to being a real, unlive effect that when you try to affect them with something, you use a little bit too much horsepower on the thing, you'll drive right out through the bottom. Only you start using powder puff techniques and they just can throw you out. For the good reason that they don't want to be any more of an effect. And you ask them to do something, or asking them to be more of an effect. This is weird. How do you get to it? How do you solve it? Well, they usually got that way because there was a lot of stuff on this. There have been a lot of people around them telling them that their cause, and cause is important. It's serious. Blame. You see what you caused now. This is serious. You ought to know better than to do such a thing. You're to blame. So on. Actually, the button behind these buttons is the seriousness with which the charge of cause is leveled at individuals. You want to start repairing this individual, you pick up about the lightest button you can find on the case. Well, it's one of those buttons on our chart, but most likely will be a serious button of some sort. You can't run anything very heavy on these people. They're way down on the tone scale. You can even get them to work a lock, and the lock won't blow. It's just too heavy. I mean, you get some sort of a lock of, well, when did sometimes somebody bawl you out? No. See, in processing, they can't be in effect. And yet they won't cause themselves to climb up the tone scale and get well. So, what do? And that's why these cases give you trouble. Now, actually, there is something you can do. You can just follow the general steps leading into the solution of insanity, mimicry, so forth. You can get them in. Because they're willing to mimic you because you're obviously alive. They'll take you over. Then you can find out who they're being insane for on a continuum. And by the way, practically every insane person there is busily being insane for somebody else, not for themselves. Oh, the nobility of the human race. They lie there and let prefrontal lobotomies be performed on them. They let electric shocks happen to them. They're shot with sodium pentothal. They will even let psychiatrists talk to them. And in other words, they go through anything, just anything, to go and hang on to somebody else's goal to be insane. That's very fascinating. There may be a faster way of hitting the case than that, but in the handbook itself, there's a little bit out of place, but is nevertheless a list, unless it got edited out. I haven't seen it in there in the printed copy. There should be a list in there of the steps, the exact steps you take to bring a person up to a line on insanity. But the one you hit after that's probably life continuum. And the case should blow very quickly. All right. You got now what's meant by cause and effect. I hear once in a while where I stole something in Dianetics. Yeah. I understand now I stole Reichian therapy. We had a couple of those around. And so all I've stolen of Reich's actually is any patient of his that came near us. Nice one, Clive. All right. Anyhow. I want to give you the source on cause and effect. Not its analysis, but on the fact that cause and effect have something to do with it. Cause and effect is Persian. I first learned of it out of a manuscript which was published about 850 AD. An old book, huh? And it talks about the role of a practitioner of the Magi. He's supposed to cause things, and it warns him not to be affected by them. That's all it says. That's all it says. I ran into that thing head on, and I scratched my head over it for some time, and tried to figure it out, and figured there was something more there than was there, and more than they knew as they were writing, and coasted along for quite a while before I finally got it disentangled. Now, you know that life continuum itself is actually postulate processing. I mean, postulates cause life continuum. It's the variety in which they're made, the difficulty of getting to them. You get that. An individual says, I'm going to try to help, and I want him to be well, and I want him to be happy, and then all of a sudden he's dead. Well, an individual has then had his own postulates torn up and thrown in his face. He said, I'm going to do something, and then something prevented it from happening. something caused death. So he says, I must have done it because I said I was going to do otherwise. And now that I'm going to do otherwise, and something else must have, I mean, I must be to blame because I said I was, and I didn't. My postulate's wrong, so therefore I'm wrong, so therefore I must be to blame on this debt. You see how that worked? Now, this is true along any line of postulates. Postulates lie behind this sort of thing. Individual makes postulate of one sort or another, and it follows on out. The trick in life continuum is how you dig up these postulates, because that's such a terrible failure that to get this death undone and get some of the somatic off of it and get it squared around and get back to the actual postulate, that required a little bit of doing. Once one understood, however, the mechanics of the emotional curve that I was discussing this afternoon, running a little bit of effort, whatever you want to do, these postulates will fall out. It's when you get the earliest postulates out of the thing that the case starts falling apart in an awful hurry. Postulates are very, very important. Now, in cause and effect, this is very, very much to the point. An individual says to himself one fine day, Well, New Year's Eve, I'm not going to smoke anymore. I'm going to be nice to my husband. I'm not going to burn any more steaks. I'm not going to talk about Mrs. Wompatattle anymore. And I'm going to be nice to the children. Now, there I've done my New Year's Day duty. Writes them all down and breaks them all on the 2nd of January. Goes into a decline and is hell to live with the rest of the year. Why? Because postulates were made which had to be altered but weren't altered. So the individual was going up against these postulates with a solid crunch every time after she made this postulate, every time after that she smoked, she was calling herself a liar because she was going up against the postulate. Now it works out this way. On Tuesday you say, I'm never going to have anything to do with Annabelle anymore. Never. And on Wednesday, you go over to her house. That is a failure. It's a failure to you with you because you said so-and-so, but then you made a liar out of yourself, so you failed. You see how this is? Now, what happens again is that an individual cannot make a single postulate without becoming the effect of that postulate because an individual is writing in a time continuum. See? He can't say, I am going to be a so-and-so, without moving on forward in time to a position where he's supposed to be the so-and-so. And he becomes a so-and-so even in his own eyes. Cause and effect. A postulate is a cause. The second the individual moves away from that point in time that he becomes affected by this postulate, and I use that affected on purpose, he is then an effect. So an individual is being continually an effect of his past. Whether he likes it or not. He's continually an effect of his past. Unless he gets swiveled so far out of valence or something of the sort, or he starts life over again or decides to be all of a sudden all over again. As a matter of fact, you could decide that and just drop all the past facsimiles and everything else, let them all go by the boards. You know, you'd have a fine case of amnesia. They'd probably pick you up, but you'd be very happy. Every once in a while, somebody does this. He just swivels completely out of valence, and he is no longer subject to his own postulates. He says, I'm somebody else. Now I am somebody else. People who change their names affect this to some degree. Now, there is why postulates are so important, because of cause and effect. A postulate is cause. A conclusion actually can become a cause. An evaluation can become a cause. And the individual moving on along his own time continuum then becomes the effect of this cause. You should be very chary of making promises. You say, all right, next Tuesday I will. You know you probably won't be there. So just before you say next Tuesday I will, make sure you say, you know, when I promise people things, I never mean it. Next Tuesday I will. You could be able to go through all next Tuesday without keeping any appointment or doing anything and feel perfectly at ease and go to bed that night with no conscience whatsoever. What's conscience? It is simply negating against your own, not somebody else's, causes, if there is such a thing as conscience. It would be that. You've said, all right, I'll be a good boy, I'll be a good boy, I won't do it anymore, I won't do it anymore, I'll be a good boy, I'll be a good boy. You know, not under duress or anything like that. And come Wednesday, you're walking home from school and everything looks fine to you, particularly those apples. So you shin over the fence, you climb the apple tree, you get a bunch of apples, you put them in your shirt, you get back over on the road again, you start walking along, and then for some reason or other you feel guilty. Now, you know nobody's going to come and take you off to jail, not for stealing some apples. And you try to figure this out. What's wrong? Is it because I'm afraid of somebody catching me or something? And you consult everything but your own postulates, you see? You consult everything else. And so you finally get the weird ideas that I'm afraid of police. I'm afraid Pop and Mama will punish me. I'm afraid I will be deserted by the whole society and left to die upon these arid plains of the Bronx. Anything but the fact that last Tuesday I said I would be a good boy. And now I'm not being a good boy. You're your own judge. And believe me, all too often you're your own executioner. Fascinating, isn't it? Now, you want to know any time in your life when you have felt guilty. You can remember some time when you felt guilty of something. You go back earlier and find the postulates you're guilty of disobeying. See, there's really only one person you're going to disobey, and that's you. That's the only serious person there is to disobey. And that's only serious until you get up the serious button. And after that, you say, well, let's see. Next Tuesday, I'm going to be the Sultan of Siam. And next Tuesday, instead, you're a hobo. Of what? You know, I've heard individuals say, you know, I have to take the rest of life unseriously, and I take only myself seriously. That goes out from the first dynamic out. And you might think that this is the sort of a thing that obtains on every hand. Well, it does. But the only reason why you take yourself seriously is because so many other people have. You see, you make, this beautiful operation. You make a person make a postulate. And then you make them make the postulate again, and make it again. And then all of a sudden you find them disobeying their own postulate. Then you say, you yourself said. Now you promised Mama that. That's the way it works. So these things start to look serious to you. Also remember that every time in your life that you got hurt, you made the decision which got you hurt. Therefore, you're liable to start taking your own decisions seriously. Particularly if you've agreed sometime or another that Mama hurt or that hurting was bad, or you're taking part in a life continuum which believed that pain was horrible. The actual truth of the matter is you could probably stand up to anything. The actual truth of the matter is, as far as pain is concerned, there's an enforced pain that individuals go through. I'll bet a Chinese torture couldn't make much of an effect on an individual unless you were severely aberrated on the subject of how much pain should hurt and how important pain was. You know where this comes from? This comes from the one life theory. This theory was arrived at without any scientific conclusion, without much thought, but was probably postulated sometime in the past in an effort to control individuals and to impress little children into the fact that they had to behave and do what they should do. Because you would have an awful time trying to control people who believed they would have another chance. Awful time. So you get them to make the postulate when they're still tottering around and tripping over their triangular pants that they only live once. And that it is serious and it's important. And then you can lay a lot of regret into the life, too. The person starts swinging along the line, getting along fine, and all of a sudden it occurs to him when he's 22 that he will never again be 21. They get married and they say, I'll never again be free. I'll never again be able to take out four girlfriends in the same night. Life is sown with these horrible regrets. And an individual begins at last to look back to the times when he should have, but he didn't. And does he regret that? Because you see, you only live once. And you'll never have another chance. Good philosophy, isn't it? This also makes you very brave on the battlefield. It's really horrendous that this boy goes out and lays down his life. That's great stuff. I mean, you can play it up real strong. Whole truth of the matter is, it was very, very fine of the guy to go ahead and do what he thought he ought to have to do. But he did it. He had full responsibility when he did. Now, there he is. The only reason that this can be considered very bad if you're holding on to a one-life theory. Then it becomes horrible. It becomes strictly nightmare stuff. Little kids start dreaming about coffins and this and that, and people are all around and are telling them, you've only got one life to live, and the kid's trying to fight himself out of this one way or the other. I would have had a very easy mind during the last war. Very easy. Hollywood might have done something right. I might have done something right sometime during the war. You never know. Listen to my superiors, you wouldn't think so. But I used to get pretty doggone wrought up on two counts. My own life was skidding by ineffectively, and my own work was not being performed. And on the other hand, the lives and energies of a great many men were being wasted. Well, I still protest they're being wasted because it's an ignoble waste. It is. And that's real waste. But if you really want to hang it as something just utterly gruesome, convince a guy that he's only got one. And then take it away from him. Now, what we will do for randomity in this society. Now, don't get me wrong, any part of any life laid down for a cause is a very worthwhile proposition. I mean, it's real sacrifice. There's no doubt about it. But don't rub it in. Now, I don't care whether you pick up this other theory or not. Just remember that you have been thoroughly agreed and had it postulated into you of your own free will out of a vast amount of phenomena which has been examined thoroughly by experts all through the ages, is found to be utterly and completely true and without any slightest contradiction that you only live one life. You know, that's one of the horrible things you can do is just show the evidence. The evidence doesn't exist on the other side and then show people that, well, you've got some. And as long as it stays a reasonable society, a society which always will agree with you when you show them the phenomena, we're safe. Therefore, does a whole new process here really open up to your eyes when you look at this cause and effect? You've seen it in the book. You saw it in Advanced Procedure. You understand this. An individual throws himself wide open to be an effect. And after that, can really be an effect. But that this is perfectly all right. In order for him to be an effect, effected pleasurably or by pleasure, he also has to be willing to be a cause. An individual who goes through life only wanting to be an effect is a sick person. I'll bet you there's hardly anybody here who doesn't have a pre-clear that once you kind of look at them, take a real quick glance at them right this instant, that you won't see that you have at least one pre-clear or acquaintance who is going through life being nothing but an effect and bound and determined to be nothing else but an effect. They sometimes will justify it by wanting to be an effect of pleasure. They want to enjoy life, they say, and so forth. They don't want to cause enjoyment in life. They want to enjoy life. Now, all of the ramifications which come off this are very obvious. You really need no more than this. If you just started to scan the times when you wanted to be in effect. And what does that lead you into? One of the things that leads you into is dentistry. Dentistry. You wanted to have your tooth out, didn't you? Well, you said so after they beat you when you were a little kid.